Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's time we all just reach over on our computers, turn up the volume on our speakers, follow along on the Wildside News website, and even visit the National Park website for 96th National Historic Site. Because all this wonderful stuff, remember, is a recent reality. It's time we head back, way back, when early English settlers ventured into the vast backwards with a few tools and a belief they could make it, when we return here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of my favorite features on the Wildside News is the Park of the Week feature. You've all, I'm sure, at some time or another, had the great good fortune to visit a national park and benefit from America's professional storytellers, the interpreters, the people who tell you about the wonders of our land, our people, and our history in our national parks. Today we visit a little gem in our national park system, the 96th National Historic Site in South Carolina. And to help us explore a most unique and somewhat fading era in our past is Eric Williams, Chief of Interpretation. Eric, the strange name 96 actually gives us a perfect introduction to today's adventure. Tell us how 96 got its name.
Well, 96 got its name during the American colonial era, and it was given to the place here by some of the first English traders who were trading with Cherokees, who were at the north and west of here in South Carolina. And the Cherokee path, which they had created, ran actually from the mountains of South Carolina to the coast. As the English traders would make their way to trade with the Cherokees, they would stop off at this place. And from here to the next Cherokee town, which was Kiawe. It was about 96 miles estimated from here further on to the destination of Kiawe, and that's why the name 96.
Well, what era are we talking about?
This is the American colonial era. This is going to be in the early 1700s. The term 96 first appeared in print in 1730 by a royal surveyor to the royal governor of South Carolina in 1730.
Well, this actually was an era before America was America. This was actually a British colony. And what we're going to do today is to take a look at that era and see what life was like. So let's talk about why there were so many people heading out into this backcountry area.
Well, the people were coming literally by the thousands from particularly the British Isles. It was a time in the early 1700s when Britain, France, and Spain all claimed large portions of America, and they were enemies at the time. Those three countries were. The English were very determined. They meant to oust France and Spain from the North American continent, so they were very anxious for their settlers to populate portions of the English colonies, including South Carolina. So they made land grants available, the English government did, so many people wanted to start new lives, some for religious reasons, and just wanted to, in a sense of adventure. Many families traveled here, and by the 1750s and 1760s, many people from the British Isles were coming to live in the back country, which is what this was called, away from the coast of South Carolina. It was called the backcountry, and many people were coming to live here.
Now, 96 Park actually, I'm sorry, I'm having some problems with my board here, so I'm having to micro-manipulate things, which is throwing me off a little bit. But 96 Park actually, when people visit the park, they're going to see some of these remnants of that era. Why don't you tell us what people may see as they come to the park?
Well, Sydney, this is a real treat, because today, this park is indeed a hidden jewel. the national park system. We have 989 acres in the park. When people come here, they can see some actual features from the colonial and Revolutionary War time periods, and very briefly, some things they may see along the one-mile walking trail are sunken roadbeds, which are, of course, dirt roads. They're not used anymore because they are obsolete, but the remnants are there. They were sunken because of the heavy travel, the wear on them from wagons and horses, walking on them for many, many decades. We have several of those in the park. We also have a wonderful remnant of the American Revolution called the Star Fort. This is an earthen, star-shaped fortification which was commonly used in Europe for centuries, and the British made one here. They built this in 1780 to help defend their outpost here at 96 during the American Revolution. But you can see the actual entire earthen Star Fort, which is still here. We also have several streams which served as primary water sources for the people and the soldiers in 18th century 96. And those are just a few of the many things which people may see when they come.
There's a lot of, it's a very interesting place, very historical, and I encourage people to go because it is, it's a time that we have lost. This is a time when America was trying to figure out which way it was going to go prior to even our Declaration of Independence. But what I'd like to really explore, because this is the Wild Side News, is the fact that people came to this place. There were no stores. There was nothing. They just went to a big woods, and from there they somehow had to manage to eke out an existence. So I think it's important for us to really realize what these forefathers and mothers and children and all the rest, and the Native Americans and the English and the Brits and everybody, had to go through to just try to survive. So let's start talking about what was meant, what was actually involved in creating a place to live. And let's start out with some of the cabins. I know that you have an historic cabin there, but it wasn't always there. People had to make that. So let's talk about how people lived at that time.
Well, it was, of course, a hard living, and pretty much every day was a day-to-day existence. Life or death struggle, pretty much. It's an existence that most of us in America today would not recognize. But our tribute is, of course, to our forefathers who did make the way to come here and to live. One of the first things, of course, when they arrived and at their place to settle was shelter. That was first and foremost. We have a lot of rain here in South Carolina. So a shelter, which oftentimes was nothing more than the first one would be just, it was called a hovel. That was a common name for them, simply a three-sided shelter with a roof, enough to, you know, get your possessions, your family in there during the rain until you could build something better and more sturdy, which normally would be a log cabin or a log house, just a bit larger than a cabin. You could use just a few tools, actually, to make either the hovel or the log house. Just a few of those tools would be an axe for felling the trees for a log house, a broad axe, which was like a big chisel to square the logs, an adze to smooth the logs and beams, a pit saw, which required two people. There was a pit dug in the ground, and one man was up pulling the saw, one man down to pull the saw downward, and you would saw your planks this way for flooring. A hammer, and of course if you had a few handmade wrought iron nails, that was helpful as well. And then lastly, a fro and a mallet, which were used to rive wooden shingles for your cabin. So with just a few tools, you could, with of course a lot of work and effort and sweat, you could produce a livable log house.
Well, now in terms of the tools themselves, where would they get these tools? How would they be there?
Well, a couple of ways. They actually could have brought these from the old country, from England or Ireland, Scotland, with them here. They could have actually been purchased in either Philadelphia or Charleston in South Carolina by the settlers and then just brought here after having purchased those.
Now, also, so they end up building a log cabin. I have no idea how long that would take, but also, and we can talk about that, we're going to kind of have to take turns talking back and forth here, so that's what's going on. But also, they would obviously want some sort of windows, and apparently you've discovered that they did have means of dealing with light, allowing light to enter.
Yes, there were several ways. For the most crude log cabins, oftentimes there was nothing. Simply an open space with a shutter pulled in the inclement weather to keep out snow or ice or rain. But then in better weather, the shutter could be opened. Of course, in would come insects, and it did allow some light to pass in the dark log cabin. But we've discovered at 96 here through archaeological digs that there was indeed window glass here. Archaeologists have determined that, and we've found pieces of that in fairly large quantities of window glass. Now, that would have come from England, made in England, shipped all the way across the Atlantic to Charleston or Philadelphia, packed very carefully, of course, and then brought here to the back country at 96. And this would also indicate that there were more than likely wealthier settlers who had made their way here and who were living here who could afford to purchase window glass. So I always thought that was quite interesting.
Now, obviously, people had to eat, and to do so, they would have to have land and this to do so. Start off by describing the nature of the forest at that time, because it was totally different from what we see now.
Yes, it was. That question comes up with when visitors come here. They will ask, does it look now like it did then? And the answer is no. Most historians in this area agree that when the settlers first came here, there was a quite a large virgin timber forest, which would mean a very high canopy, maybe 200 or 300 feet, the top canopies of the trees. And then not much undergrowth. Today we have, of course, smaller trees and a lot of undergrowth, a lot of scrub, which would not have been like it was at that time. So you'd have large virgin trees, the high canopy, and then pretty much open underneath. So this is pretty much how it would have looked. There would have been some fields as well with natural grass savannas. And a mix of really hardwoods and pine, different varieties of pine. Hardwoods would have been trees like maple, oak, beech, walnut, and also chestnut.
Now, in terms of water and food, what would be the source? Let's talk about water first.
Of course, I guess the most essential element that people have to have is water. There are accounts that we've discovered here, contemporary accounts of the abundant water sources around the environs of 96, and those would be rivers. The Saluda River is about 9 miles away, quite an abundant water source. We have springs, creeks here, numerous springs and creeks, and also people may choose to dig a well, and most wells could be dug 40 or 50 feet down and it would strike water. So there was a fairly high water table apparently at that time as well.
Now, as well, they had to have food like meat. What was involved in that process?
Well, of course, one of the essential tools which had to be brought to the back country here by the settlers would have been a gun of some sort. And this, of course, would have been for protection and also providing food for the family. It would have been possibly a rifle or a hunting gun, like a shotgun or a fowler, it was called at that time. And game was abundant. There was black bear. There was white-tailed deer. Small game, like turkey, rabbit, squirrel. These were all in abundance, and some of those even are today as well, especially white-tailed deer. But many people are surprised to learn, too, that there were buffalo here at that time. One historian from South Carolina said it was a slightly different type of bison than our western bison. It was at that time known as an eastern bison, just a bit smaller, but looked identical to the one ones we have out west. So those were in abundance as well. So the place was around here was teeming with food sources with wild animals.
You know, we've been talking just about one little era. This was kind of the 1760s and 1770s, but this park continues in terms of its history, and you've got about a minute left. I'm going to give you a chance to talk now about what happened after that. Give some of the highlights, and then I encourage people to visit the park to hear the rest of the story.
All right, 96 has two themes, and we'll do this real quickly. One is that we talk about 96 during the colonial days prior to the Revolutionary War. Then the second theme is during the Revolutionary War. 96 figured prominently in the American Revolution. The first battle south of New England was here in 1775, November of that year. That's very significant. And a large siege occurred, 28 days longest of the Revolutionary War, occurred here in May and June of 1781. It was an effort by the American Patriots to wrest 96's control from the British. It was a large British outpost at that time in South Carolina. So there's so many stories to tell here, and it's worth a visit to come and see it all firsthand.
You have that right. You know, Eric, I want to thank you for telling this part of the story, and there's so much more to this. Thank you, Eric. When we return, we're going to be talking with Flora, Gloria Flora, about the Rocky Mountain.